The Dr. Taz Show.
The podcast. Dr. Taz.
Your good health journey starts now. Here's Dr. Taz.
Welcome back to the show. And for everyone out there listening today, we have a treat for you. This is going to be your chance to ask all those questions that you are just too scared, too shy, or too embarrassed to ask. I know because I've thought through these as well. Joining me today is Dr. Alyssa Dweck. Dr. Dweck is a full-time practicing OBGYN at the Caremount Medical Group in Westchester County, New York. She provides care to women of all ages and has delivered thousands of babies. She writes prolifically, contributing to Cosmopolitan, Shape, Family Circle, Health, Women's Health, and Girls' Life. She lives in Scarsdale, New York with her husband, their two sons, and their English bulldog. Welcome to the show, Dr. Dweck.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Well, we are thrilled to have you. And, you know, so many of us get together in girls' groups and talk about some of the things that we're going to talk about today, but often they never come up in the patient room. And there's so many different reasons for that. I know, for example, that almost 83% of Americans go to the doctor. That's about 922 million visits to the doctor. But usually you have anywhere from 3 to 10 minutes to talk to your doctor. So you're really afraid to ask some of these questions. And in your recent book, released just a couple of months ago, The Complete A to Z for Your V, you tackle this stuff head on. So what inspired you to write this book? And for our listeners out there, tell us a little bit about, you know, what your experience has been and how this book came together.
Right. So my purpose of writing this book really was to try to speak to the masses about questions that people are, exactly what you said, a little bit embarrassed, ashamed, shy, or what not to speak about when it comes to vaginal health and gynecologic care. And you're absolutely right. Our doctor's visits have gotten shorter and more pressured, so it's even more important to have valuable and, important information out there in the form of a book, because you never know, some of the information online might be misleading or misinterpreted and difficult to navigate.
I agree. And, you know, I have longer doctor visits because I have an integrative practice and it's a little bit more time-based. But even with the length of time that we have, it takes a certain amount of a patient starting to get comfortable with you and really being able to open up. And even though my visits are longer, on the way out the door, you'll get that, oh, by the way, can I ask you this? And I can't imagine for the patient in that short visit how between both you and the patient, there's that opportunity to bond and get these questions out there. So I think this book is great. These are questions, you know, even somebody like me might have had at one point in life and just never wanted to ask some of the questions. So let's break it down a little bit for our listeners. What do you think some of the most unasked questions are that you see amongst some of your patients or your girlfriends or, you know, anybody kind of within your community?
All kinds of things. So, you know, this can range from intimate grooming. So, you know, hair removal in the genital area is quite popular right now, and I get all kinds of questions and concerns about that. And with that comes anatomic questions, where people are really worried and concerned that their nether regions, if you will, look different than other people's, because I guess now with so much hair removal and pictures on the internet and those types of things, people are able to compare and they want to make sure they're normal. In fact, that's the huge question that I get all the time. Is this normal? So that's one question, intimate grooming and anatomy. A second thing, and third and fourth, and we'll go through whatever you like,
yeah,
always has to do with sexual health. Is it normal that sex is hurting a little bit? Is it normal that I'm not really in the mood? Is it normal that I'm feeling a little dry? So these are very common questions, and I like to reassure people and give practical advice that could be helpful and get to the bottom of the problem, of course, if there is one.
Definitely. Well, let's start with intimate grooming, because sometimes I'll get some of those questions too. And ladies, we're talking about going down there, going down to your nether regions, your vaginal area, talking about grooming that area. Are there some clear medical rules about grooming? What's recommended? What's not recommended? What do you tell your patients?
Right. So, you know, this is all very individual and whatever people's preferences are in terms of whether to keep a fair amount of hair in the general area or remove it in certain degrees. I think the trend, at least in the community where I practice, is that less is more when it comes to hair down there, if you will. So people are removing more and more hair. What are things that I like to discuss? Well, lots of women come in with lumps and bumps after hair removal, usually from shaving and getting an infection in the hair follicles. So there are different ways to try to prevent this, whether it's using a different form of hair removal like waxing or laser or something along that line, or taking precautions like using a hydrocortisone cream or a warm sitz bath or using an antibiotic ointment immediately after hair removal to prevent this type of thing from coming up.
Is there a preferred way to groom that area? I know there's, like you mentioned, shaving, there's waxing, I know there's laser hair removal.
Right.
You know, what do you, is there one better than the other? Not necessarily. What do you think?
I think that it depends on the person. So, you know, for example, laser hair removal, very successful, very popular, best for people with dark hair and lighter skin. Because it doesn't leave as much scarring. And it's certainly important to go to somebody who's experienced so that you don't end up with some sort of a side effect or complication. But again, that's expensive and not for everyone. Shaving is probably your easiest, but also the one ridden with lots of lumps and bumps, if you will, and razor burn. And then waxing, a little bit uncomfortable. There are certain tricks of the trade that you can try, like don't go right before your period when it's going to be a little bit more uncomfortable. And again, make sure you go to an experienced esthetician to do this. But it's really individual preference.
And if someone chooses laser hair removal, is it a one-time treatment and then they're done, or do they have to go back repetitively?
Usually it's repetitive, and then it lasts a whole lot longer than a lot of the other quicker hair removal procedures. But touch-ups are usually recommended maybe every 2 years or so, depending on the amount of hair somebody has.
Gotcha.
Yes.
Yeah. While we're talking about how everything looks down there, let's talk about smell as well, because I get a lot of questions about that and a lot of concern and honestly some anxiety too from different about how things are smelling. So is it, you know, what's a normal smell that your vaginal area should have? We all know that smell changes as you approach your cycle. It can change after intercourse. Talk to us a little bit about what we should be looking for, what it should smell like, what we can do to improve it.
Sure. So, and I would welcome any of your suggestions because I think this is such a hot topic right now. But in general, I really like to get the point across that the vaginal area is supposed to have a smell of sorts. And this whole idea of spraying fragrances and perfumes and trying to mask the natural smell is just unnecessary. The vagina has incredible mechanisms to keep itself clean. It keeps its own pH balance in most cases. And most women are familiar with their own smell. So if something is off or awry and it's not just related to the menstrual cycle, women know about this, and usually I would say bring it to the attention of your healthcare provider. Certainly a really foul odor, a fishy odor, a odor that's different for someone that's also associated with abnormal bleeding or an abnormal drainage, these are things that need to be checked into because it might be a sign of an infection. So those are typical pearls that I give my patients.
I mean, I think those are great. The only thing I would add to that from my perspective, more living in the integrative and the functional world, is that your vaginal pH is reflective of your overall pH. So if you're noticing a shift or a change, then again, think through, have you made a dietary change? Have you made any other sort of lifestyle changes? Are you drinking alcohol more than you used to? Because sometimes that change in odor, if it's not one of the more severe things that Dr. Dweck just mentioned, sometimes it's simply a shift in diet, lifestyle, you know, and some of your self-care regimen, and really paying attention to those things can make a difference. And for some of those patients, you know, we've done things, I don't know if you've done this before, but we've done, you know, vaginal probiotics along with oral probiotics because they seem to gradually shift that pH, remove sugar and yeast from the diet. So those are some of the other things maybe that we would add in, but it's first critical to go through some of those first, you know, thought processes that you mentioned. You know, is it a fishy odor? Is it a change in color? Is it foul smelling? I mean, that needs medical attention, you know, not just trying some of these things on your own.
Right.
I'm sorry to interrupt. No, please go ahead.
Yes, I was going to say, after you mentioned the dietary items, particularly in some of my younger patients, high sugar in the diet definitely can alter the pH. So eliminating that or moderating it, and alcohol for sure can help with that. The other thing that comes to mind is condom use. And this is not necessarily to prevent sexually transmitted infection, but more to keep the pH stable in the vagina. So along with probiotics, whether it's oral or vaginal, for people prone to constant infections or odors that they're concerned about, we'll often recommend condom use to keep the pH a little bit more stable.
Great advice. Well, you mentioned another common question that many women want to ask but maybe don't. You know, their sexual health, their libido, you know, is it normal to want sex, not want sex? You know, what is average? Talk us through that. What do you see in practice and what are women telling you about sex? I know all the time they're coming in, the most common complaint for me is, I have no libido. I am not interested. What is wrong with me? My husband's right. getting upset or my partner's getting upset.
Talk us through that.
Why do we have no libido? What's happening to women?
Okay, so, you know, women are complicated, and so is their libido. So it's not a light switch that gets turned on and off. In most cases, there are so many factors that are contributing to female libido. So first and foremost, hormonally. You know, hormones have a whole lot to do with libido. So certainly women approaching menopause or in the perimenopausal transition before they actually lose their period for a full year will notice a change in their sexual drive. And it may truly be in part biologic, where their hormones are changing and either replacing them or doing some other conservative things might be helpful to enhance libido. A second thing that comes along with age and also just with life are general life circumstances that cause stress. And stress is going to be a huge buzzkill in the bedroom for women, whereas men tend to be able to, and of course I'm generalizing here, men tend to be able to put these things on the back burner. Women don't often do that. They'll have what we call the busy mind, where they might still have a little bit of a libido, but once they think about the 20 things on their checklist to do for the day, it just goes away. So that's something we try to manage with stress reduction. Sexual pain is another big issue that we're
yes.
dealing with, especially with the perimenopausal and menopausal woman, because they may have lower estrogen levels and therefore drier vaginas and some sexual discomfort, which of course is going to make that an unpleasant task. So we'll work on that with moisturizers and lubricants and other ways to enhance moisture. So these are just a couple of things that contribute to female libido: medications, chronic illness, relationship issues, which is something that I mm-hmm. usually cannot fix in my office, so I leave
right.
that to my
right.
mental health colleagues to help with. So it is a complicated issue, but definitely one that should be addressed. And I think the gynecologist or the integrative medicine doctors are going to be the people that women feel most comfortable discussing this topic with.
I agree. I mean, I think we are complex. We're hormonal. We're structural. We're products of our relationships. I mean, there's so many factors at play when it comes to libido, but I do know it has a profound impact on relationships. And for a lot of us women, I know women that can go years without being intimate, but it absolutely stresses their relationship or their partner or the intimacy that their partner feels towards them. So I would urge women out there, you know, if you're experiencing a shift in your libido, you know, definitely get it checked. What do you think, Dr. Dweck, their first step should be? You know, maybe at least seeing an OBGYN like yourself and making sure from a structural standpoint things are okay, from a moisture standpoint things are where they need to be. And then in our integrative world, we are often checking hormones and looking at hormones to understand what to do there. Would there be anything else you would advise the woman who is noticing a shift or a change in her libido?
Right. Well, I really addressed most of the variables that we spoke about. So I always address relationship first, just because I'd like to get that part of things started with an outside counsel, if you will. I always address a general physical exam, because after all, a woman with diabetes that's undiagnosed or unchecked
yes.
or untreated may be having, let's say, constant yeast infections in the vagina, therefore pain during intercourse, and so really getting to the root of the problem is going to be most important. Women with, let's say, depression or anxiety who are on medications that might be interfering with libido, So, for example, some of the SSRIs or the antidepressants in that family of medications can really dampen libido and cause orgasm issues. So these are things we'll address and maybe change medications out. I'm a big proponent of checking a whole panel of hormone levels, including the thyroid.
Woohoo! Thank
yes,
you.
Yes, I like that. So, I rely on all of my colleagues to help out with this. So, if I pick up a thyroid problem, I need either an integrative medicine specialist or an endocrinologist to address this, because that may be the crux of the matter. Someone with other hormone imbalances due to menopause or due to some sort of shift needs to be addressed, and often I'll replace hormones when it comes to that problem.
Perfect. I love that. I mean, I think so many of us walk around completely unaware of where our hormones are, what's normal for us, what's not normal for us. And so when we do have a problem or an issue, we kind of don't know what home base looks like. So I feel like I've spent a lot of energy, and I love it when, colleagues are embracing that concept of, yes, let's get our hormones checked. We need to understand who we are and where we are year to year.
Let's shift a little bit. One other thing I meant to bring up is the fear of pregnancy. So
yes.
Some women also will really note a low sexual drive, and it's a subconscious concern about getting pregnant because they don't want to and they don't have adequate contraception. So that's something that we always address as OBGYNs, because we're very comfortable with that subject, of course.
Yes, and I would. Oh, my gosh, I have so many questions for you, and I'm looking at the time. So, again, these are straight from my patients. A lot of them have questions even about contraception, especially the younger women. We all know that birth control and birth control pills are an option, but there's a pretty significant part of the population that has trouble with birth control for a number of different reasons. I know there's been a shift in the last 5 or 6 years of moving towards IUDs and IUD placement in younger women. Can you talk a little bit about that and educate us all? I know when I was originally trained, you never did an IUD. I believe children, and I think a lot of people are still walking around kind of thinking, in terms of that. But I would love for my younger women out there who are struggling with the issues of contraception, which could in turn be affecting their libido or even their desire to be intimate, what some of the best contraception options are out there today, aside
from
birth control.
So I have one sentence about IUDs. These
yeah.
are not your mother's IUDs or your grandmother's IUDs. They're so different. So there are now hormonal IUDs that contain no estrogen. So I think that's a really important point. They contain progesterone only, and they are teeny tiny, so that even for our younger patients who have not been pregnant yet and are concerned about discomfort, are really, really terrific candidates for these smaller hormonal IUDs. Not only are they incredibly effective for birth control, because there is really little human error when it comes to their use, but they also are well tolerated, and I find that my patients, if they take a non-steroidal like Motrin or Advil before they come in for placement, they really do just fine, get up and walk out in 10 minutes and go about their business. And that's most people. So people do well with this. I always get the question about fertility and is there effect on fertility after these IUDs
yes.
have been used. And the truth is, if you pick your candidates wisely and women are still practicing safe sex if they have more than one sexual partner, the risk of problem with fertility later on is really, really quite low. And so we find them to be a wonderful option for young women.
And when you talk about picking your partner wisely, are you meaning more in terms of screening for STDs and those type of diseases?
Oh, picking
correct?
My patients wisely. Well, what I do is pick patients wisely, meaning that, yes, somebody who, if someone has 10 active sexual partners, they may not, and they are, mm-hmm. refuse to use a condom, I don't consider that to be an ideal person for an IUD just because of the risk of infection. But most women, come in very well educated on the subject matter, and I find that, women are very, very willing to consider IUDs once we can calm their moms and grandmoms down that it's not going to
yes.
alter their fertility for future like the old IUDs did.
All right, ladies, I hope that's helpful. You get contraception. There's so many options out there. Don't be afraid to be intimate with your partner simply because of contraception reasons, whether it's birth control pills or IUDs. There are more options available today than there were even in my time or our parents' time. All right, let's see if we can get one more in. I get asked this all the time, and I think there's been a lot of confusion, especially after some of the changes have been made. What are the PAP guidelines for today? When do you need to get your first PAP? Does it matter if you're sexually active? And then how frequently should you be doing PAPs moving forward?
Right. So I just want to distinguish between a PAP smear, which is the actual test that we do to screen for cervix cancer, and a preventative gynecologic exam, which is the entire history and physical exam and discussion about whatever other gynecologic issues are of concern. So we still recommend a gynecologic exam for people once a year in most cases. The Pap smear, though, has changed significantly over the past few years, where the first Pap smear screening is not due until the age of 21. So lots of women have come in, and they should come in for their annual checkups before a Pap smear is ever done. After 21, we typically do a Pap smear every 3 years, and we don't start doing screening for that virus called HPV, or human papillomavirus, until the age of 30. And that's when we do Pap smears and an HPV test, because this is the age group of women who are a little bit higher risk for cervical cancer. The one last thing that has changed is that after age 65, we don't do Pap smears at all if someone has always had normal Paps before.
Okay, so let me make sure I got it. So no Pap smears necessarily when they turn 18. First
Correct.
Pap at 21, Paps every 3 years thereafter, and really no Paps after 65 if everything has been normal. And if you've had a hysterectomy or any of those type of procedures, do you really, I get asked this all the time, do you really still need a Pap?
Right, so if you've had a hysterectomy for reasons other than cancer, you typically do not need a Pap smear. There, of course, are individual caveats that go along with all of these guidelines, and I'm not going to set the stage for lots of confusion by naming a bunch of them, but the standard is every 3 years or even every 5 years for women 30 to 65 to do a Pap smear and an HPV test. So in my practice, we typically do a Pap smear and an HPV test for women over 30 every 3 years. And that seems to be the currently accepted guideline and really is going to pick up most cervical cancers well before they're ever cervical cancer.
Gotcha. And now, what if, two more questions. What if you are not sexually active at 21? Do you still need a Pap? And second question, if you have not done the HPV vaccine, you know, at 13 or so, 11 or between 11 and 13, as it's recommended currently, does that change any of those guidelines?
Right. I'm so glad you asked about that. So as far as vaccination, if you've gotten the HPV vaccine, and most young women do get it before they come in for their first gynecologic checkup, you still get screened in the usual way. Remember, the current HPV vaccine does protect against 9 strains of HPV, but there are over 150 strains known, so we still do want to screen people.
Okay, great. And then last question, that Pap at 21, if you're not sexually active, do you still need it?
You still need it. You still get your first one at 21 and every 3 years thereafter, yes.
All right. That is a chock full of information. I hope everybody could keep up and was taking great notes. If you want to learn more about what Dr. Dweck has to say about everything down there, check out her book, The Complete A to Z for Your V. You can also find her on her website at Dr. Dweck, that's drdweck.com, and on Twitter and Facebook at Dr. Dweck. Dr. Dweck, thank you so much. I know this is valuable information. Hopefully everybody's leaving here today a little bit wiser and smarter about their lower area, and we will look forward to having you on again in the future.
Appreciate it. Thank you so much.